Eigentlich genau genommen, diesen Januar war ich in Ludwigsburg auf so einer IT-Security-Konferenz, die zwar unglaublich viel Geld kostet, wo aber die Leute die Möglichkeit haben, richtig gute Leute ranzuholen. Da gab es Koryphäen wie Bruce Schneier, die dort aufgetreten sind. Unter anderem auch Rüdiger Weiß, der seinen Vortrag hier schon gemacht hat, und auch Jair Balou. Das Thema, über das sie spricht, hat mich damals eigentlich ein bisschen von Socken gehauen und mich daran erinnert, dass ich sie auf dem 19 C3, also vor 2 Jahren auf dem, vor einem, ja, 1,5 Jahren auf dem Chaos Communication Kongress dazu schon mal gehört habe. Ich habe sie gefragt, ob sie jemanden in Deutschland kennt, der also über dieses Thema hier was erzählen könnte, und sie hat mir angeboten, warum soll ich es denn nicht machen? Und ich war da so froh drüber und bin es immer noch, dass sie heute hier ist.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for having me. I understand that the CCC doesn't have the funds to fly people from wherever to here to just give a talk for an hour, so I really appreciate their efforts. And this is not my first time in Germany, but this is actually the first time I bought a Deutschland shirt. So I'm very happy about it. I just bought it 5 minutes ago. So anyway. And I know a little bit about German interception, but that's not going to be the focus of the talk today. We're going to, I'll can explain about how German interception systems work and what the primary laws are in Germany. But we're going to just look, if it's okay with you, at the general things, legally and technically, in lawful interception. And then I have a rather entertaining video that normally is only shown. I did not show it at the CCC in Berlin. I only showed it this January at the IT Defense. It's normally only reserved for if you are working for the CIA or the FBI or another secret agency. Those are the only people that get to see the video that I will show you today. So that's fun. So let's just start. If you have any questions or I'm speaking too fast, which I do because I'm American, please stop me. You know, you have to start screaming and say, slow down, or you have to ask for some help with the translation. So please just stop me. I don't mind at all. Okay. So what we're going to talk about is we're going to do just a quick introduction to what is interception, what is tapping, and what kind of tapping are we talking about. So does it mean that the government is listening to all your traffic just whenever they feel like it? What is the basis for tapping within the European community? How is it done in each specific country? What are the reasons that the government can tap you? How can they tap? What is the framework for tapping software and hardware? And then we'll talk about some standards, but I'm gonna just gloss over the standards because it's very technical and it's super technical. So I gave this talk at a RIPE meeting for operators, but I think we're gonna leave that behind in this talk. So just leave it a bit more general. And then we're gonna talk about some actual suppliers of hardware and software and explain their techniques. How do they work? How do they differ? And then we'll watch a video, and then we'll go back to some future developments and issues in lawful interception and cryptography. Ooh, this is loud. So ETSI, which is the European Technical Standards Institute, what they do is they define a technical standard for all communications providers. So if you are an ISP, if you are a telco like Deutsche Telekom, or if you are, I'm thinking, is it heise.de, the website, you know, content providers? So depending on the type of communication service you're offering, ETSI defines best standards-based approaches to tackling different things. So security issues, communications issues, frameworks for all different kinds of standards and protocols. What ETSI has defined it is lawful interception is different than unlawful interception. Unlawful interception is a 12-year-old putting a sniffer on a corporate network. That's illegal. Unlawful interception is also the government, yeah, deciding that they don't like your haircut, so they're gonna, you know, start tapping you at will, at random. That's unlawful. Lawful interception means that there is a warrant. Someone went to a judge and said, he doesn't just have a bad haircut. I think he killed his girlfriend and paid this guy to kill him, kill her for him. You know, I'm sorry. I'm just, you know, the people in the first row, they always suffer. So, so the That would be the reason for the tap. So you know that the crime that this person has potentially committed is a basis for prison time or a basis for a very large fine. So because it's so serious, that's why the police can go to the judge and ask for a warrant to tap his communications. This is only for citizens. So if you're a German citizen, it has to be with a warrant. Me, I'm an American. I have no rights. So within Germany, anyone, any German official can tap me at will because technically I have no rights as a citizen in Germany. Also, foreign communications. So if there's satellite traffic from MCI, that's imagining that there is no working together between MCI and Deutsche Telekom, satellite traffic and satellite communications, that's all open to free for all. So anyone can tap foreign communications. That's allowed. So you only need a warrant when it's national citizens that you want to tap. Is that clear, that idea? Okay. So the way that it works is very simple. You have a law enforcement agency. We call them the LIA. Yeah, the LIA sends the lawful interception order in the form of a warrant over to a network operator, so Deutsche Telekom, or what's the biggest Deutsche ISP? It's also Deutsche Telekom. T-Online, right, T-Online. So then they send it to, but you know, Strato, right, depending on what you're using. So and you send the order to the ISP or the telephone company. Am I talking too loud? I am, sorry, it's my Americanness. Or the website service provider in question who's providing the actual service to the user. They then deliver that information in the format that's requested by the authorities to a law enforcement monitoring facility. I'm going to refer to them as the LEMF. The LEMF is a network. They're just technical guys. They sit behind their computers. They wait for the stuff to come in. They try to figure out what it is, and then they send it on to the relevant body that requested the tap in the first place. Okay, I actually build tapping systems. So I build the network infrastructure that helps support a commercial tapping system. And the reason that's interesting, it's not really that interesting, it's the same thing as positioning an IDS system, an intrusion detection system in the network. It has to be properly placed so that the IDS can capture all the traffic at a few points, so that you don't need to put the IDS in every point all across your network, but you have it only a few points. The IDS should never be a cause for delay or latency or anything else in your network. It should function seamlessly. One more question. Is this being taped at all? Yeah. Where? I'm going to ask you in a little while to turn off the tape, but okay? All right. So in any case, the IDS, what they're doing is that they're placing it in a way so that they can be very efficient with the kind of traffic capture that they're doing. So they capture just a little bit of traffic with a little bit of equipment. The equipment will be secure. It won't be vulnerable to any kind of denial of service attack. It shouldn't be visible from the outside, etc. These are the same kinds of things you want from a lawful interception system. You don't want it to cause a burden on the current production network, and you also don't want it to be subject to a new vulnerability. It shouldn't be a weak point for the rest of the network. If the rest of the network is strong, so should the lawful interception system be. Okay, so why do we intercept? Well, we intercepted in the Czech Republic because it's part of an EU mandate. So when the Czech Republic wants to join the EU, they have to have an interception system in place. It's just that simple. Thank you. Thank you. And obviously, the reasons that you're going to hear in the media is because of terrorism, of course, because, you know, everybody's a terrorist. But if you ask yourself how many intercepts are actually done to get terrorists, they're very few. They're not intercepting to just catch terrorists. They're intercepting to catch people who commit commercial fraud, you know, who try to steal money from a company that already has too much money. You know, those are the people that get intercepted. So, but these are the reasons that governments give for really intercepting. So very serious crimes, murder, pedophilia, cyberstalking, data theft, the saucer worm, you know, those kinds of guys you want to intercept their traffic, you want to see what they're up to, you want to know what they're doing. Drug dealers, of course, they're all on the internet, right? No. obviously, there are some very basic reasons why not to intercept, the biggest being privacy concerns. if you're intercepting, are you doing it correctly? Are you obeying the laws that you're only intercepting the intercept target and not everyone else's traffic? So if I assume, I have to pick on you too, but if I assume that he killed his girlfriend and he had his girlfriend killed because this guy actually killed her, that I don't start tapping his traffic by accident because they live in the same house or they're lovers or they, not that you are, but something like that. Yeah, I have to be very careful with the kind of traffic that I capture. It's just the sitting in the first row. It's much easier for me to identify. So those are the basic reasons. So we don't want the TAP network to be used for purposes that it was never intended for, so that it doesn't respect privacy concerns. And you also don't want it to be used as a point to attack the rest of the production network, so security concerns. So those are really basic things. And obviously there's different individuals. The privacy concerns are done by the community at large, and security concerns are directly from the communications party. So the operator is worried, hey, if I have to put a interception network directly over my network, how will it affect my network? That's their concern. Is that clear? Okay. All right. There's a lot of blah blah on this slide, but what it you'll get slides from me from later. I'll just mail it to the organizers and you can get them. But basically what this is about is it's saying when you go into a court, the judge asks the counsel, the lawyer, am I going to hear the truth? And the counsel says very cleverly, no, your lordship is going to hear the evidence. There's a fundamental distinction between the evidence and the truth. And this is never more clear than when we're talking about data evidence, primarily because the normal things have been evidence. I'm going to have to pick on you again. But so let's just say you had, sorry, no, it was your girlfriend, right? Right. So it was, you had killed his girlfriend. So obviously there are some things that we know. There's a bank transaction between the individuals, right? They paid some guy money and he went out and bought a Ferrari or maybe a Volkswagen. I don't know how much money he gave you. But so there's this thing and we have this as evidence. Aha, you know, this guy, there was money from this party to this party and then this party did that with the money. Also, at the crime scene, how would you like to kill her? Poison? Okay, but let's just say that you gave her an overdose of something that leaves massive traces in the body and her body's pulled up to a balloon and it was all horrible and she burst in the living room or something. So now, there's a lot of evidence there, okay? So there, for example, so he bought this poison and so he goes to the drugstore to buy rat poison or something, I don't know. And then, so he has it and then he has fingerprints on the rat poison, so he keeps the bottle at his place, of course. And the girl, she died and you can examine her body for forensic evidence and you see the remains of the rat poison and you see like tissue samples over the ceiling. So you have a clear cut thing. You have a guy, and maybe also this girl had a dog who ripped up the cushions on the sofa, and as a result, she wanted to monitor the dog, so she had a little webcam in her living room. So when he poisoned her and everything, that's all can be seen, right? So now we have evidence. It's pretty clear. We have a videotape of him or via the webcam, you know, kicking the dog and poisoning the girl. And sorry, I have to make you an animal hater too, right? So we have this evidence, and then we also have the fact that this transaction occurred between the two individuals, so we have another target, we have another suspect here. So we have something very clear, yeah? So that means that observes the standard characteristics of evidence. The evidence can be admissible into court because it's all can be correlated directly to this individual's. It's, you know, the evidence in Germany will be allowed into court as evidence. It's authentic. I can say I saw your fingerprint on the rat poison bottle. I know it went from your account to his account. I can explicitly link the evidence to the individual, right? I have your face on the video camera. You know, it's clear. You killed her. So, and then finally, it's also going to be accurate. It's going to have an actual story that I can say, none of this data that I'm looking at as evidence was tampered with. It's actually the real evidence. It tells a thing of the actual events that occurred. It's also complete. So I can see when he came into the house, kicks the dog, feeds the poison into the girlfriend, when she explodes, and then he leaves again. So it's a full story, yeah? It's from the beginning to the end. It's not missing anything. And it's convincing. So if I'm a jury or a judge, I understand what happened here. Everybody understands what happened here. He hated his girlfriend. He needed a Ferrari. There you go. It's clear. Now let's take another example. So let's imagine that it's not so easy, that it's actually data traffic. Is it admissible? In Holland, it's not admissible as evidence. So if I just have a telephone intercept or an email that he wrote to him, it is not admissible as primary evidence. If I only have an email, I cannot say for sure that he committed the crime. Okay? By the way, am I being too general or vague? Is this too easy for anyone? No, okay. I'm just going to go on. But I can explicitly link the data to the individuals with the actual story. I can say that it's accurate. I can't actually say that it's accurate because I don't know, like, when the collection of the email happened, how it was stored, how it was kept online. And I actually can't say that it was explicitly linked, because just because an email came from your email address doesn't mean you wrote it. Anyone who had access to your computer or your internet account could have written that. So I can't say explicitly that you wrote it. I can't say explicitly if you wrote an email back saying, "I killed her, job done, thank you, it was fun." You know, I can't say that you wrote that either. So there becomes a lot of issues why, with a lawful intercept, when you actually have the collected evidence, that it's none of those things, that it is neither admissible nor authentic nor accurate. Furthermore, because of the nature of the lawful interception software, we very often miss packets just along the way, just because you're trying to filter a needle in a haystack in terms of traffic. So you're trying to get a couple of K of traffic over gigabytes of trunks from an ISP, it doesn't always work. So sometimes we don't have a TCP disconnect, or we don't have a radius disconnect, and we miss all kinds of traffic. So as a result, it doesn't tell a complete story. It's not a full session of traffic. And finally, you know, a judge or a jury has to sit and decide when a lawyer comes and a lawyer study a bit, that he has to decide, is this really true? Is it really possible to spoof an IP address? How the hell is a judge going to even understand the word spoof in the first place? You know, so is it possible to spoof an IP address? Is it possible to hack into someone's computer via something called back orifice? What is that? You know, and so they simply cannot make these scientific or technical decisions. That's not what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to make legal decisions. And as a result, they're at a loss when it comes to these kinds of investigations. Because when two lawyers get together with some network engineers and they all have a convincing story to attack each other's evidence, well, the judge has to decide, or the jury has to decide. And they're simply not capable always of making an appropriate decision. So these are problems. These are just issues that we face. I'm just going to go over this very quickly, but the issue here is admissibility of surveillance evidence. So all these problems. It's hard to the locus delicti means a virtual scene of the crime. It's not a real crime scene where you can put tape around the body of the dead girl, you know? You have to be like, okay, it's all virtual. It's all on this hard disk. Do I really understand this? Is this permutable data? For example, right now in lawful interception, when you do an intercept, there's no hash over the packets collected. The packets are collected real time, transferred over to the law enforcement monitoring facility, and they're just sent over. So you have no way of knowing if what you've actually captured at the law enforcement side is the same thing as what the ISP or operator sent. There's no way of comparing the two. They simply don't do a hash. One of the ideas that's being suggested now is, if you were to have a public server, a third-party server maintained by a university, I'm just saying something, but hypothetically maintained by a university or some other public entity, it's just a server that collects hashes. So just before the intercept gets sent over to the authorities, there's a hash, just an MD5 hash, poof, checksum. We keep the checksum over at the public server. The actual intercept traffic gets sent over to the authorities. Easy correlation. And then when it gets back into court, you can compare the hash results with the public server. And if the authorities try to screw it over to make him actually, or him guilty, you know, that can't happen anymore. Is that clear, that idea of the hash? Okay. I'm not sure how technical you guys are, so I don't know if I should begin discussing this stuff or not. Finally, what's the decisions that's made? The decision that's made is the way that you're going to treat intercepted traffic because of all these problems is it's never going to be treated as the smoking gun, or the poison in this case. It's actually going to be treated as, I overheard this guy say he was going to use poison. it's not the best possible evidence. Yeah, it's treated as less than the best possible evidence. It's treated as a somewhat of a copy of the actual evidence. So it's treated as secondary. So that's after all this work, after the LEMF sent an order to tap, after the ISP or the operator actually began the tap, then you still have this issue where it's finally inadmissible in a court of law, or not admissible in the West way. Okay, so when we talk about interception of internet services, what do we mean? Very basically, we're talking about access to the internet. So if you are a provider, you know, hello. Okay, I'll call you back, just tell them that. No, I'm sitting in a very important talk, and yeah. So, no, I'm kidding. But we're talking about just basic access to the internet. So in this scenario, the reason that we talk about what are the internet services is to define responsibility. Who is responsible for tapping your traffic? Is it Deutsche Telekom? Is it T-Online? Is it maybe Colt Telecom, who's monitoring the dial-in boxes for Deutsche Telekom? Is it MCI, who's managing the interconnect traffic? Is it KPN Quest, who I don't think exists anymore in Germany? But anyway, hypothetically, it could have been them. But who gets served the intercept order? You know, these are all issues. By the way, I'm going to tell you just a little anecdote. The last time I was here, I built an ISP that failed miserably. It was called planetinternet.de. Does anyone know it? I built it. It died. I'm sad. Okay, so, and then we also define it as the services that go over the internet. So if you're talking about World Wide Web traffic, yeah, and if you have a chat site that's online, you could be also served with an intercept order. If you have accounts that are created with real usernames and passwords, and you can explicitly show logs of IP addresses, originating IP addresses, and you can correlate them that way, you may also be served with a warrant. So this was just looking at, okay, well, how are we looking at dividing up the responsibility? Then you know what kind of services we want to tap. Is that clear? Okay. So we're also talking about chat, ICQ, FTP, Telnet, any, you know, protocol that runs over the connection that you provide. That's what we mean when we talk about IP services. So it's all the traffic, everything. Okay, so what about encrypted traffic? How many of you use PGP? Very good. Phil will be so happy to hear that. Last night, I had dinner with, do you guys know Philip Zimmerman? The ones of you who use, he was in Amsterdam. He's actually going to do this company thing in Belgium. Maybe I'm not allowed to say that. I don't know. But he's a friend of mine. And so we had dinner, and he was talking about the fact that, you know, PGP was cool, but nothing would be cooler than a fully software PGP phone, like fully encrypted voice traffic, but not voice over IP traffic, because that's too much latency, burdens, blah, 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 too much setup. Anyway, I shouldn't even tell you, but he thinks it's something that he's still developing. But the point is that if you use encryption, if you're using PGP, if you're using, I don't know, VPNs, or what else do I have in here, Nautilus phones, no one's ever heard of those, but if you're using any of that stuff, you're fine. You're fine. Because the issue is that the operator is only responsible for providing traffic from that individual. So if I'm supposed to capture his traffic, that's all I'm supposed to do. If he's sending encrypted traffic as an ISP or as a telco or as a pure access provider, not my problem. I send over his encrypted traffic. You know, it's a challenge. Let them break it, you know, and use quantum computing to figure out the Diffie-Hellman algorithm and blah. I mean, just not my issue, but it becomes my problem, and it is a problem actually in France, where one of the biggest issues that I think it's a threat to your freedom. They want to have key escrow. They just want to take everybody's keys and keep them in a little bank all to themselves. And if you don't do that kind of encryption, it becomes illegal. This is now being dropped. I mean, they're not going forward with this, but these are things that are under discussion because of the fact that if a network operator or a service provider is providing SSH to their users, then they are either responsible for giving their keys over to the law enforcement authorities, or they have to first strip the traffic of the encryption and then provide that over. Are any of you working for ISPs? You are. What would you prefer to do? Would you provide your SSH keys over to the authorities? Okay, so you would just strip the traffic yourself, yeah. That's what a lot of people prefer, because key escrow it can be is basically you're allowing them carte blanche to take your traffic out whenever they want to. So that's, I think, quite a danger. But the point here is use encryption. If you really want to make it difficult for them to tap you, just use encryption. Okay, here's logically how it works. Don't know how technical you are, so I'll just keep it pretty simple. The idea is there's a user, he's coming in over a DSL link or over a dial-up link, just a standard PSTN link. He's going over a telco domain, so let's say that this could be, by the way, a separate party. He could be getting his DSL connection or his actual last mile for his PSTN connection from Deutsche Telekom. And then there could be a separate telco domain that's providing that access, either the DSL access or the PSTN access. It could be a different party, like a different company in between, yeah? Deutsche Telekom. I'm not sure what the company would be in Germany. Maybe it would be Colt. I don't know if Colt Telekom would do that. Media. Okay, so I don't know if you heard MediaWays, Accor, or
QC.
So they would be providing then this layer, the telco domain layer, but the actual tapping and the way that Etsy has defined it and the way that the majority of the actual infrastructure works is that they try to place the responsibility of the tap as close as possible. This is a best of breed approach, by the way. This is not that everyone does it this way, but this is the best way to do it. Is they place it as close as possible to the actual service to the end user. And in this case, this would be the ISP domain, because they are actually responsible for end user services in this example. And what we're tapping is with just a splitter, just a hardware splitter, you split all the traffic on a switch to a different switch port, a completely different piece of hardware. So you have hardware coming in over your Radius server. Your Radius does your authentication for your user. So they give the user an IP address, either a permanent or a static, depending on how your Radius is set up. Static or temporary, I should say. Thank you, killer. No, just kidding. No, I'm just so kidding. But it's good to see you're all awake. So they either provide a temporary or a static IP address to the user in question. And the idea is that you're going to capture from the beginning the Radius Connect. So you know what IP address you're correlating to the username and where to begin the tap. So when you start that, you send it over really to the switch, which just splits all of the traffic. So not just for that user, but for everybody's traffic. It just takes all of the Radius traffic. And then on the switch itself, the switch has to now then be coupled with another box that places the actual sniffing functionality. So it basically, a switch has three main tasks here. So first what you do is you forward all of the traffic over to the switch with the splitter. Then you filter the traffic just for the relevant user, but that's based on a higher level software package or interception hardware, whatever, but it comes from there. So you have a username for the tap, you have a cryptographic key that needs to be applied for the tap, and you have certain information about the tap itself. So all of that information gets applied at that layer when you're doing the filtering, and then you forward it to the relevant, let's say here, this separate router that's now going to forward it to the law enforcement facility. Yeah? Is this clear? So forward, filter, or capture, filter, forward, I should say it that way. So you capture all the traffic, you filter it just for the one killer person, and then you forward it all through to the authorities. So, and the authorities in this case could be a national secret service as well as a civilian police, so just a local police, just one second, or the international secret service. Go ahead. Sorry? The filter rules. Well, I'm going to go over that in just one more slide, but basically, the idea is that the filter rules are applied semi-automatically. So you are supposed to have like two factors. You have X and Y. So X was a known factor, which is the username of the target. Yeah, so you have the target's username, and then you need to correlate the target's username, which is the basis for the warrant, yeah, with his IP address. That's the only way to tap. For IP tapping, I mean, that's clear. But what you're trying to take is all of the IP traffic that the user sends, so all of it. And right now I have it on, when you see the little red lines, it's just splitting the Radius traffic and the mail traffic. But the idea is, like, let's say there's an outgoing router that's a single router. This never exists, of course, in an ISP architecture, but hypothetically, let's make it simple and we make it only a single router. Then you would also have a little red line going between this router that's also filtering all the outgoing traffic. So if there's additional protocol traffic in addition to mail, then you would be filtering all the TCP to IP traffic, and then you would do it on that router. Or you could also do it on the incoming router, so the router where he has to actually begin the access onto the network. So everything he does is filtered through that router. It's just like placing an IDS. It's exactly the same. You look for the best points in the network to tap the traffic. That's it. Okay. So what are the technical challenges with IP taffing? Well, the first one is maintaining at the same time that you're actually conducting an intercept, that you maintain transparency so that nobody knows you're tapping. This is really important. Why is this important? Because if you have a small-scale network and you're monitoring a DSL user or a couple of DSL users, if all the DSL users decide at the same time, the target users, to spike their traffic, and they're sitting on the other link, they shouldn't notice a lag because their traffic is spiked, that the interception is also spiked, that the outgoing traffic is then spiked. Yeah, over a separate link. Is this idea clear? They shouldn't know they're being tapped. So the software, I mean, of course, there's going to be in an ISP a single security officer that's going to know about the interception hardware that's on the network and about someone who actually enters the crypto key for the tap, etc. That's all going to be there. But the point is that otherwise, it should be seamless. It should be a separate network functionality. It shouldn't have any effect on a production network when you're tapping a target on that network. Okay?
Does this include copying network frames without, for instance, increasing TTL?
Well, it's not frames because it's layer 3. So the packets, yeah. But your thing is you're not touching the packet. You're not molesting the packet in any way. You should only capture the traffic that's being sent, and you only start touching it after you figure out what individual you're tapping. And even then, you don't really touch it. You just pass it on. Yeah. And the nice thing is that for the operator or the ISP, the only thing they're responsible for is capturing. The actual deciphering of whatever the hell the traffic means, the traffic flow, the reassembly of the packets for figuring out if it's a real piece of mail that says, kill George Bush, you know, which is all good. I'm not saying that you should advocate killing anyone, of course, but if you had to choose someone, you know. But in any case, so those are the things that we're talking about. So that's the responsibility of the authorities to figure out how to put it all together, but it's the responsibility of the operator to give it forward. This is a nice model. I don't know how many of you agree with me. You probably think I'm some horrible government person that, you know, taps everyone. I think that the more the more involvement you have with the ISP or the operator, when you say, you know what, as a government, when you say, it's not my problem how you tap these customers. I'm going to give you an order to tap. I'm going to give you an order of following all the right rules. I'm going to say, I only want you to tap because I think this guy killed his girlfriend, or I think that, you know, someone wants to kill George Bush. Oh, okay, you don't have to tap that. But if they're going to, I don't know, bomb the Aldi because there's this horrible hacker conference next door. You know, so that kind of stuff, you want them to tap that. But then you want the ISP or the operator in question to say, okay, I'll figure out how to do the tap. It's my network. I know how to do it. I'm only going to tap this one person and nobody else for you. And I'm going to only follow the warrant order strictly to the letter. And I'm going to check with the judge to make sure that he wants this tapped. Yeah? When you give that kind of responsibility over to the ISP, when you share it, you have a sort of checks and balances system to make sure that you're not going to have a single party abusing this incredibly powerful thing. So, and not always. This doesn't always work. But, I mean, it's a better scenario than leaving it a black box allowed to clamp onto a network at any time and go, yeah, that's bad.
How long is picture the delay between the order and the tapping happening?
That's a very good question. And actually, it depends per country. In the Dutch law, it says that from the time that the warrant was issued to the time that the operator begins the tap, it should be a time frame. The Dutch have this ridiculously difficult word. It should not be onverwijld. And onverwijld means it should be reasonable. Yeah? Should be a reasonable length of time, whatever that means. For me, that means two cappuccinos and a half an hour later. And but it could mean something for everyone, you know? So it's a highly decipherable thing. Also, if some ISPs, well, we'll go over that in the other slides. I'm just going to follow the slides. Yeah.
As far as I know, in German law, it's immediately. You have to do it. You
yeah,
get the...
immediately.
Yeah,
sure.
But if you have only some customers, which is below 1,000, then you have more time, which is,
yeah.
I think, 24 hours.
Yeah, but okay, that's still a nice slur. But it, when the thing with that, and I understand that concept as well, is because the obligation to tap and to have a tapping system in place increases as your amount of money that you have as an operator increases, and that's logically connected or should be logically correlated depending on your CFO. And I've seen some very bad CFOs. So, but depending on the correlation between your customer base and your revenue, of course, you know, it determines whether or not you need a tapping system in place, whether you tap 5 individuals or 50. That's logical. But the Dutch, what did I do? Okay, so the Dutch system is not so strict, so it just has that. Very simply, how many of you have heard of Carnivore? Okay, I will explain what it is then. Carnivore is a system that was used in the United States to tap all the traffic from the ISPs, and it was just that system that I told you that I was scared of. Basically, the FBI would go knock-knock to an ISP, come in, you know, dark glasses, the suits, black box, and they would say, show us your network. And then they would see the network, and they would say, oh, this is a good spot. And then they would plug, you know, just clamp their stuff on. It was a black box running Windows. And and that black box would then just suck traffic. The ISP was not allowed to touch it, go near it. They made sure that it had power and that they didn't connect the Christmas tree to the same power of line that the thing was going on. But that's it. So the thing just had to be given there, sit there. God knows what it was tapping. Maybe it wasn't even tapping criminals, you know? Maybe it was just doing its own little internet worm propagation from the ISP. You don't know. So I'm giving you conspiracy theories. The FBI put out Sasser. No. No, but the point is that you just don't know. This network, it's when you have an interception device, it has to be sometimes intimately connected, very, very cozy, to that production network. And you just, unless you can verify as an operator where it's going, what it's doing, how much traffic it's collecting, there's no way of telling whether it's also just a device that receives traffic or if there's also outgoing traffic from that box through your network. You just don't know. Okay, I think that idea is clear. The other challenge, of course, is the filtering switch that's supposed to forward or capture forward filter. Those switches, sometimes, like you said, you know, how much time does it take before you set up the tap? That's also a technical challenge because, which I think it was an Extreme Box, where it took, or was it Foundry? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it was Foundry or Extreme anymore, but we placed the filter. When you added the filter, it took almost a full 30 seconds before it would actually begin collecting. 30 seconds, not millisec, 30 full sec. That's ridiculous. 30 seconds, that's like eons of time, you know, before it would actually begin the intercept. And it's too late. It misses too much traffic. And the idea is this. A switch manufacturer will never say, we're really good at taking a lot of traffic and then throwing it all away and just keeping this. Do you understand? A switch is supposed to forward all of the traffic it gets as quickly as possible. All of it. It's not supposed to miss stuff or drop stuff. That's not what a switch is built for. But it's because the actual implementation that's being done for interception software isn't thinking about things like maybe we shouldn't use a switch as a hardware device, but maybe we should use fully ASIC-based hardware firewall that is good at throwing packets away, you know, that it's not supposed to forward everything, that it really does do a quick packet inspection and quickly chucks what it doesn't need. So in any case, right now, there are not enough effective filtering switches. The way that the software has been written, the way that it's being connected to the network, that's the kind of hardware we're using, and it's just not as effective in not missing disconnects. The other issue is packet reassembly. This is on the government side. So the interception side of the software is one challenge, and then so just capturing it and forwarding it, and the other side is actually getting it, receiving it, and making it something coherent for law enforcement. So that's just not as it should be, and it's way too hard. So as a result, of all the intercepted traffic that they actually do collect, 90% of it is just thrown away because they don't know what to do with it. They simply don't have a clue. So they'll keep some SMTP traffic. They'll keep the initial radius connect and disconnect so they can correlate it back to the user, and that's it. So, and sometimes they keep ICQ in chat. I'm going to show you some other things they claim to do, but I've never seen it working in a production environment. The other thing, too, is that because this is supposed to be incredibly complex software, it gets really buggy really fast. This was the number one problem with Carnivore. So Steve Belevin testified before Congress, you know, about Carnivore when they asked, well, how does it work, really? So he told Congress, it's like using a plastic spoon, you know, the plastic spoons that you throw away, to perform brain surgery. Yeah? So imagine if all the brain surgeons did that. That's what Carnivore did. So that's how good it was. And the final issue is that because you're talking about monitoring users who demand, you know, gigabit Ethernet, and they demand XDSL links in whatever flavor, you're talking about large bandwidth connections. To monitor large bandwidth connections and intercept them effectively and put them back to the law enforcement monitoring facility, the law enforcement facility has to have gigabit trunks, you know, ready for their disposal to receive all this intercepted traffic. And of course, they don't have that. So as a result, now, as an operator, you've done your job, you know, you've intercepted this bad guy's traffic and you're sending it forward. And the authorities go, oops, our router is down. You know, or this link is down, or the link is crap, or we chucked all the excess packets because it was just too much. You know, we were over 80% of our capacity. Sorry. You know, so this is all quite sad still. The last one is one of the biggest problems to date. Okay, just really quickly over this. How much time do I have left? Okay. Oh, God. Okay. That's not good. Okay, so what's it based on in the EU? There's a lot of stuff. The big ones are the Convention on Cybercrime. I told you it's not Carnivore. It's not going to be based on CLIA, which is the American standard. I'm going to run through this, okay? It's a standards-based approach, which means that they're not going to build interception capability into protocols. This is a really good thing. So this means when you start using IPv6, you don't have to worry about a field, which was originally in the initial IPv6 protocol discussions in ETSI and within the ITU. They said within IPv6, we want to put in a little field, which we're going to call a law enforcement field. And this law enforcement field will have a little area where we know how to intercept an individual's communications. That's not there. The IETF said, screw you, you know, protocols should be secure no matter what. We refuse to put interception capability in a protocol. The EU, the parliament, the whomever, the guys who get paid way too much money to fly all over the place and stay in expensive hotels, those guys, they actually, you know, they had a brain fart and said, oh, that's actually a really good idea. We should make these protocols secure. And then, of course, they lost all reason and started spending too much money again. But that was a good choice for them. So it's a very good approach within the EU. So quickly, European legislation, and this was, I don't know what it's doing, okay. Okay, the point is here is the question that you asked, I think, about when you have so many users, the time to tap. Was that you? Who asked that question? Was that you? Not just the delay, but about if you have 24 hours? That was you. Don't deny it, see that? No, the point is that there are two requirements. You can either have a permanent solution, yes or no, and or you can have a flexible solution, yes or no, which means that the ISP gets to decide how he does interception. Now, I have here for Germany, yes, it's flexible, but that's not really true, because the best German intercept, or the most, I should say, the market share of German interception software is done by a company called G10. It's the same name of the same company that also, it's named after the law, actually, Gatesin. You know, it's on the internet. You can look it up. It's Googleable. And at the time, the UK was more stringent. So the government was actually recommending what kinds of solutions would be used in this arena. And they said, no, it shouldn't be such a flexible solution. So it was supposed to be a mandatory, obligatory something. Okay. Quickly, European legislation. I just want to point out, I don't know how many of you can see the slides, but I'm trying to make a thing, a case here. You have in France, you have this group called CNCIS, the Commission Nationale de Contrôle, blah, blah, blah. And what they do is they are an officiating body to say, okay, when the government officials ask for a tap, we're going to screen those taps and we're going to grant some of them and we're not going to grant some others. Because something dodgy started happening in France. Like, they noticed that suddenly there was a lot of taps for the opposing political party and for journalists and for other people who are not so popular within the government. So obviously you can't just tap them because, you know, you don't like their haircut or you don't like what they write about you or etc. So that's why this commission was developed. And this commission then screens the intercept orders. But the most interesting thing is there's a specific law that made interception more readily available and much more easy to do and to ask for. And that is la loi sur la sécurité quotidienne. And that, if you notice the date, is November 2001. Just look underneath to Germany. The Counterterrorism Act was January 2002. The G10 was 2001, but I don't think it was just November. I'm not sure if it was before or after 9/11, but that's the case I'm trying to make. A lot of these laws were lying on the shelf, just waiting for an opportunity to be put into action and to be ratified and passed. But they needed something like that, a bit of paranoia, you know, to have this ability. And that's, so the G10, the Gazettes for, I'm sure you guys all know this because I'll kill it if I say it out loud. But the point is that it was just the fundamental basis for what you are allowed to tap on. I have some interesting things about Germany, but I can mail them to Peter later and you can get that. I had a diagram from the G10 interception software providers, or hardware providers, I should say. And basically, what it looked like they were doing in their first release was just doing Cisco port spanning. How scary is that? That means the interception's actually happening on the production box. That's just nuts. But the chances are... Yeah, it's insane. But okay, the reason it's insane for the less technical is because if you try to do the same kind of traffic capture on the same box that you're sending your production traffic on, the box will die. So you have nothing anymore, you know? So it's really rather stupid. It's also a Cisco issue. Cisco, the backplane of any Cisco device, pretty much to date, it cannot handle all the traffic that it's capable of receiving on all of its ports. So it's not a fully meshed crossbar fabric. So that means if you have 10 ports with a gigabyte each, the backplane's only 3 gigabytes. So what happens to the other 7? You know, that's okay. Right. And then I have a very good quote for you here. And it's basically, it's a very long quote, very boring. But it's the guy who I thought was MI5 for James Bond. But he's not James Bond. He's like the FBI James Bond guy. And it's the UK Home Secretary. And basically, he has this very long quote where he says, September 11th was a terrible thing, but what a great thing it was, because it gave us all these good budgets for interception, and now we all realize how dirty and nasty all those horrible terrorists and criminals are and why they're all over the place. So it's insane. So you just see that the intelligence community sees this as a great thing. You know, September 11th, finally someone gets it. You know, finally there was this horrible attack, and now we can do all our fun trapping. So Holland happens to be the number one interceptor in the world. Coincidence? I think not. Okay. But I think they're not really the number one interceptor. I think they're just the most honest about the amount of IP tapping that they actually do. So if they do 300 taps, they tell you they do 300 taps. If France does 300 taps, they say, oh, no, I think 3 or so, you know. So they just don't tell you otherwise. And in the Netherlands, they're rather honest about the amount of tapping they do. They have different criminal codes. They have an act of where they explain how they do it. And most scary is that they have a new wet proposition, a law proposition that went into law very quietly. No one knows about it. Or no one knows about it. They just, no one made a fuss about it, I should say. It's a decree that says you don't have to be convicted of a horrible crime in order to start an intercept. I just have to think that you're a bad guy, and any police officer anywhere in the service can start asking for a tap on anyone. That's just alarming. So the guy that writes you a traffic ticket can say, you know what, he looked suspicious. Well, you have to get a warrant, but he can ask for it. He's allowed. He's authorized. So, yeah.
That's what's also going on in Germany and the EU. I thought that this example for the music industry and the movie industry can do this.
They're bad people too. So, in any case, they've also have a standard in Holland. It's called the TEET standard, which in English sounds really rude, but what it actually is, it's the predecessor to the ETSI standard. So the current ETSI standard that's just been released in February this year, so 3 months ago, is based for a large part on this Dutch standard, which is actually very good. It's quite concise and it explains quite a lot. And they have a national interception office that coordinates all the interceptions from the different governmental parties. And they also have a central bureau for telecom, which coordinates how the intercept goes from the authorities to the different ISPs and the different operators. So for example, like, how am I going to know which ISP my target's at unless I have this coordinating agency? That's how you know. So they actually coordinate the whole tap order. Okay. I was going to talk to you about ETSI. How much time do we have? Because I don't know if I should do this.
I think 5 to 30 minutes.
Okay. I keep having more time. It's just really good. Well, quickly about ETSI. The point is that they have a big modeled layer, and they try to make it as close as possible to the ISP. They have a best standards-based approach to how they look at interception. They put the majority of the responsibility on that service provider, and they've got several documents. The one that you're seeing up here on the slide now is not a standard, but it's a technical report. And what it gives you is the way that ETSI thinks about interception. So it's a TR 101944. The current standard that's been released is the TS, so technical standard, 101.232, 233, and 234. And the reason they released three rather than one is that the first one talks about handover mechanisms for IP delivery. And the reason that we talk or we even use the word handover is because what it's about is handover between a government authority, so the police or the CIA or the FBI, has to have a method in which to ask for information and have it in a protocol level, and then also receive it back from the authority, from the operator. So that's when we talk about handover, and we have a model for that within ETSI. I'm not going to explain the whole model because it's rather technical, and I don't think it's that useful. I can always explain. If you have questions, I'll be more than happy to answer them in email. But basically, the idea is this. You have several basic flows for handover going between the law enforcement domain and the network provider domain. And those basic things are, like for HI1, I say, I would like to tap, and I'm going to ask you to tap for me for 6 months. Here's my cryptographic key for only this specific tap. So when you tap with this key, it's only going to go to my interested party on the government side. Then HI2 is going to be information related to the intercept, target name, target IP address, session begin, so time stamping. That's all going to be in HI2. HI3, handover interface 3, is the actual content of the tap. Please kill girlfriend, stop. You know, we'll pay you 2,000 euros. Stop. No, okay, that's a little money, but that's not enough for a Ferrari. We'll negotiate. Stop. You know, like, that's the actual content of the information. So we get the idea of what the different handover interfaces are supposed to contain. And within the operator, you have two basic functions happening. You have an internal interception function, and you have an internal network interface. The network interface is the production network, and the interception network is the coupling between the production network and the tapping network. Clear? Any questions? Excellent. Okay, so what does basic architecture look like? Now, remember this slide a little bit, because the law enforcement agency decides to send a warrant. The warrant goes to a warrant administration desk, which then gets forwarded to an ISP. The ISP puts it into a slightly intelligent management box that then handles the cryptographic key for that intercept, as well as the duration of the intercept, the other information, the HI1 information for that intercept. It again gets to specific interception boxes that actually collect all of the traffic. So it goes to different S1 entities. From those entities, it then goes to a separate box that's only responsible for gathering all the traffic, bundling it up, placing a hash over it, actually sending it forward to the different law enforcement facilities. So those are the T1s on this side. And this is where you have the handover interfaces 2 and 3. So handover interface 1 is happening here with the management box, and 2 and 3, the content of the communication as well as the intercept-related information, is going across to the government. Clear? Okay. Where it not only gets packaged out by these different collection boxes, it then gets sent to the relevant law enforcement agency. The reason that this is interesting is because it means that the CIA can tap the FBI and vice versa. They can all tap each other if they want to. That's why there's a separate cryptographic key for each intercept. So if the FBI starts an intercept, they place their own key and only they can read the actual intercept that's been given, and they can easily tap the same target. Also, like, several agencies can be tapping the same entity without knowing it because they all have different intercept orders, different keys, different administrating boxes. Maybe the security officer of the ISP or the telco knows, but that's also highly in doubt because he gets these intercept orders. It's all on a CD-ROM. It gets fed into the management box, and it's done. As long as the warrant checks out, as long as the target checks out, as long as the law that's been violated checks out, the warrant is going to be done. Is that clear? Yes.
Is there any information available about the strength of the key? The qubit length?
Yeah, it's just a standard Diffie-Hellman 2048-bit key. We're not talking little kids play. We're talking serious business. I like your marijuana shirt. Is that what it says?
Yeah.
I'm from Amsterdam. Well, I'm not really from there. I live there, but I don't smoke. It's
bad. Can you get a bit more detail about this management box?
The S3 box, it's just a box. It's not that intelligent. It just starts a thing. So it sets up the filter, for example, or it sends the filter request over, depending on the architecture you're using, either over... I was just thinking, are they going to stop me? I'm sorry?
Is there any possibility for our bot?
Grid mode administration, no, it shouldn't be, no. And there should be encryption between the boxes because the S1 can be in a different geographic location than the S2 as well as the S3, so there should be encryption between all of these boxes as well. Yes. Yes. No, really? Okay. All right. Okay, I'll just run through this. Are we stopping taping? Have we stopped taping?